No, that's fine. So no, we have noted the point in the break. I think they're the one relating to the self-funding and the realignment of funding. That's what you want us to assist you to look into. The question of the immigration laws that are problematic. You might have to assist us with some details in terms of what we need, so that you don't sound generous when you speak to more police. And the question of the funding at owner's level. This is the point that you raised specifically for us to maybe as we get members also to start engaging with it. You might just want to address some of the letters that are raised in your report on page 47 by the Auditor General, so that you just tell us how you're responding to this. Those are just letters. I must congratulate you for not having a qualified position on this post. That's something very that we appreciate, and we know the effort the RNRF has put into achieving the show. It's definitely exciting when you present it, and it looks like you're on the right track. On the last point, people raise the vision, like 2020 or 2015. The question that always comes to my mind is that how many of them are going to be there to see the vision too? I've noted in other bodies and institutions and councils that people put very ambitious programs and projects and visions, knowing that halfway through the line they won't be there to account for the implementation or non-implementation. So that's a matter that we're going to monitor very closely. As to who will be there to assist us to carry this through. Looking into your contracts and everything else. I'm not sure. Once you organize yourselves as to who will observe those matters, because they will also come up, let me give to members also to engage on this. I see your hands in that order. Mr. Howard, or is that? Mr. Farrow, Dr. Muhammad in that order, and then Mr. Tedder, and Mr. Lord. You can just follow that. But I actually thought that let's take maybe two people at a time just to respond, so that we don't take all the questions. We'll take two at a time and get the response.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to refer you to page 12. My concern is that in terms of jobs and research per researcher, I want us to apply our minds, how do we actually look at this as researchers being employed? I mean, you did indicate that we're quite down the line when we compare ourselves to the international market. How do we see jobs in terms of this? And then also, in terms of the PhD, you've given us statistics of 2003. Do you think we could get in the short period of time the updated version of 2007, if it's possible? And then also, what I was wondering, in terms of the demand side of the knowledge economy or the knowledge capacity of global trends, has your institution actually looked at that in terms of the global need of what research is required? Because there's many talks with regard to export of knowledge base. I think we do have challenges, I agree. But with regard to our vision and our outcomes, are we looking at that as a possible line function where we will be able to export? I think that's what's going on, the talk in the economy, where we're saying we're building our knowledge base. So we studied that part of the demand side of the knowledge base? And perhaps I want to also, you know, I'm looking at your at the people that have come in here, and I'm looking at the youth. How are we recruiting the youth? Because what concerns me greatly is the impact of AIDS. Whilst we are so optimistic that we are going to train these people, How are we actually rationalizing on that challenge of ours? We do have a challenge. And it proves your whole contingency here in terms of the youth. Where are we fitting them in? And how do we see that challenge coming up? I think that's more or less what I needed to say. I looked at your booklet here, this one. And I looked at your page 63. There's some transfers that you've indicated. Perhaps if you can just comment on that. And then lastly, I think I was concerned about page 58. You have quite a bit of depreciation. Have you got that? Okay, so that's about it. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chairman, yes, one of the mandates of the NRF is to, through funding, to promote research. Now, we seem to be not getting the research done at the right places at times. When I say that, I want to look at what happens in South Africa lately at high levels of the three administrations, local government, provincial government, as well as national government. There's a lot of people sitting there who's already got qualifications, who can make a major input in preventing us getting a lower quality of functionality at these various levels. Let me take an example. We have seen lately that water and the treatment of water is becoming a major problem throughout our local authorities. Because we have lost a lot of knowledge and technical competence in that area. But there's also sitting in those administrations people whom, if we can get them to do some research, come up with papers on how to improve and how to maintain these facilities, then other people in the same administration would benefit, because we have lost people to other parts of the world. That's but one area. Another area is the roads and the building of roads. We have a major problem on road accidents, and some of the road accidents, the cause of it is the way the roads are being maintained and constructed, and we are building more and more roads than what we've ever had before. And we need to get those people with the knowledge to come back and say, this we have tried and it works. For instance, in Scotland, they've done away with most of the traffic lights. They are now doing roundabouts. That's what they call a circle in Scotland. And they've cut down on the road accidents. And therefore, I think a lot of research must be... you must go back and get the people working in local governments to do some research and put it onto papers and come back. Because they've already got the background knowledge, they've got the qualifications, they have been doing the work for many years. If one looks at the younger generation to come up with that, they have not yet had the experience to be able to come up with this kind of a research. A researcher is a person who should be at least about 25 years old if you want to look at what he can gain. Some areas of research, yes, you can take the younger generation, but I think what South Africa now needs is research in some areas that must stop the cost of governing. Because once we can cut down on the cost, we will have the money to get the knowledge gain that you are looking for. And I really would like to see us do more in that area, Mr. Chairman. I've got some other questions, but I'll put them later. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and honourable members. The questions you talked about, Honourable Chair, there were three of them, perhaps four. One was had to do with the balance between core and reinvent funding. That's the area that we are appealing to the honourable members of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee and Sciences to advocate for an increase somehow. Multiplication of the allocation that we have to be able to carry out the mandate of the for which the NRF was set in the first place at its foundational level, i.e. to fund research and so on and so forth. And as I said before, we could do the amount of work we do a lot more thoroughly and a lot more effectively and efficiently by having that amount of money allocated to raise. I don't know the best way to do it, how you do it. In some systems, we've heard different entities in the landscape, various departments do contribute a core grant to the research activity of the country. Because our research is countrywide, it's not just specific areas, it's across the whole range of activities, as this honorable member, Mr. Blanche, has indicated here. And so for us to be able to get into those areas, we need real funding to be able to capacitate the NRS effectively. We can, the other members of the, my delegation can elaborate on that. The second question Honorable Chair raised was the international researchers, the problems that they encounter in the way of being recruited to come here to South Africa. And he wanted examples of what you should be telling as you go around trying to advocate for us to help us in this regard. And as we were focusing about this, the members of my delegation had several stories, and I'm sure they will come up with them. I do have a personal one that I shared with you, how I had actually failed the driver's license here twice in 1975 before I got it the third time. Worked very hard, and it was on my club book in Germany. And I went overseas, went to, another member here knows that, he knows that I went to Cornell. They looked at my license and said, it's an English-speaking country, you know the rules of the road, therefore we will give you a New York license, just like that. 25 years later, I come back to my country, and I'm supposed to buy a car. The car people will not sell it to me if I don't have a South African driver's license. So I contact the people in the driving bureau and said, here's my passport. I still have my license. You know, I'm licensed here. And here's the American license. I've been driving 25 years. No, you must be tested. I said, but I was tested, and I failed twice, and the third time I got it. I already had a PhD in chemistry when I failed. And they said, no, but we don't have the records of KwaZulu-Natal here. And so we have no evidence that your license, you ever got it here. You have to be tested. I had to write to the Minister of Transport, Honorable Jeff Adair, a long letter explaining that how can I be treated like this in my own country? When I went overseas, I was decently given a license there. And I have a responsible position in the country. I need to have a reasonable car to come here, but I cannot get it unless I have a license. Well, yeah, I got a response from him after a while that you must go to America and get evidence that actually this is a genuine license you have. But what about my KwaZulu-Natal license? No, you had a window of time by which you had to turn it in order to get a new one. That window is closed. Honorable Chair, this is just an example of somebody like me who had the patience and the desire to leave this country, had to go through. Now you can imagine someone who doesn't originate from this country having to be taken through that. Forget, let alone the line just to stand through in order to be served in the Department of Home Affairs or Traffic Department and so on and so forth. But the other example I gave was a radio astronomer who was recruited actually and offered a position at the university here in the Western Cape, whom we ended up losing. That was more a function of us being blindsided by the need to, when we approach these high-level people, to understand that they have spouses who are actually terminally qualified themselves in their own right. That when we approach them, we should approach them with a package deal that includes the wife and treat the wife in a separate category as a bona fide person they themselves, which they did not, and the Australians did, and they ended up taking that particular radio astronomer to Australia. But I'd like to let our colleagues share other examples of international frustrations here. The other thing you did, Honorable Chair, asked about was the honor funding. We at the NRF have proposed a two-step way to address the honors and master's and PhD funding levels, because right now the funding levels are at 8,000 for an honors person, 33,000 for a master's, what is it for a PhD? About 7,000 for a PhD. And we are thinking that in the short term we'd like to double the honors allocation, at least to be in par with what undergraduates are asked to pay, at 15,000 or so a year. And we think by approaching it through the shoestring approach, we can master that 15,000 very, very shortly, and thereby some way towards attracting honesty. But realistically, we should go up to the level of the masters for the honors, something like 30,000 to 40,000. So that student who graduates with a 3A degree, a brilliant mind, can make the choice to stay on in the honors, knowing that they won't be committing economic suicide and turning their back to the needs of the family. So it's a quasi income of some sort. Not quite at the level they would get if they went to work, but enough for them to make a living and then contribute somewhat to the family upkeep at 40,000. And we think we want to increase the master's to 70,000, we want to increase the PhD to 120,000. And when you play out those numbers, the impact might be way over the budget we have in the NRF. But when we look at it, we think that that would put it at the requirement for people to take masters and PhDs and honors as a much more stronger footing. The other thing we're considering, and I already shared, is make it smooth for people to get to that honor here by dropping the requirements for people to apply for that extra year. Because in other systems, students stay for 4 years without having to pass the third year with a higher mark. Like in this case, you pass by 50% from first year to second year, 50% second year to third year. But before you can get to honors, you must pass at 55%. But why are we creating this extra hurdle for people, whereas now the degrees, like in engineering, people go for 4 years with the same criteria for passing? We want to smooth that and remove the hurdle for people to have to try to jump by having that extra fourth year be an automatic year to which people can go, thereby putting them in a position where they can go into a master's and apply to a master's. On that level, we have conversations also to make that entry point of the master's to be an entry point to the graduate program. So the transition from master's to PhD should be similar to people shouldn't have to jump the hurdle to do a PhD. But without looking around, some of the master's thesis that you see around here can easily qualify with a little bit of upgrading to a PhD thesis. Why are we ending up after 3 years awarding people master's degrees? I don't know at this point in time. So we are engaging with the people in the higher education sector, with AFTAP and others, to try to make these transitions possible. I let my colleague Vishen Singh to address the financial questions that came both from each year and from the Honorable Mohammed, as well as the other members of the committee. Let me pause here and let the other members comment.
This
one.
Thank you, Chair. Let me speak firstly on the Auditor General's report. Chair, firstly, the Auditor General, in my opinion, working very closely with their department, is doing a sterling job. Not usually.
Because he's sitting next to Pence.
I don't think this thing is working. Can you hear me?
Take the other one.
It's on, but it's not working. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, let's try this one. Can you hear me? All right, I'll try and speak louder again. It certainly has been a challenge with the Auditor General. We are a very complex organization. I mean, from the presentations you have seen, we run anything from high-tech instrumentation to running a zoo. So it's not a simple organization to run, but nonetheless, the challenges that prevail, in my mind, as a CFO, we are adequately addressing things in that organization. So, In addressing the basics of accounting, control, and weaknesses, what has happened is that the Auditor General obviously has moved up a gear or two, and is now, if you look at our audit report, they're very technical in nature. The matter of emphasis clearly identifies is with regards to equity accounting. Now, the NRF has the Innovation Fund as part of the NRF, and the Innovation Fund's primary activities is to invest in companies that lead to commercialization. The case in reference Geratech, Chair, that matter has subsequently been resolved. The issue around that one is that both us and the investing in the company in which we have invested have a similar financial year end, 31 of March. So it's impossible for both of us to have audited financial results at the same time when one institution's financial results are flowing and become consolidated into the holding company, the NRF. in this case. The Innovation Fund has the opportunity to produce an annual report subsequent to the NRS one. And if you look at the Innovation Fund's annual report, that matter of emphasis has now been removed. So it's a matter of a timing. The other issue is around salt. Salt does not have an active market share, so it is very difficult to get market results or market value of the shares that the NRS holds in salt. Their salt also has the same financial year end as the NRS at 31 of March. But what we have done to alleviate any kind of misnomer or to ensure that there's transparent reporting and that it's reported on a fair basis is that we've made a full and total disclosure, and I think that is what the Auditor General has also noted and has also referred to page 6 with regard to that disclosure. The second point, which the Auditor General also these days report on other matters, and not just generally whether it's qualified, unqualified, or whether there's a matter of emphasis, the Auditor General Act has extended the reporting on behalf of entities which the Auditor General audits. The other matters that have been raised by the Auditor General is the audit report received from higher education institutions. Now that is a challenge for us here because in particular, NRS does not spend the money that it receives. Our money is spent at higher education institutions. We have to actively engage with the higher education institutions out there, and it sometimes is a nightmare for us. What we do is we constantly visit these institutions, make them aware of our processes, the administration requirements, what we require from these higher education institutions, and we have our staff sitting out there on occasion. The other matter that was raised is the IT weaknesses in the NRS. As the CEO mentioned in his presentation, certainly it's a challenge. We are highly IT intensive because most of our proposals that we fund come through the online processing mechanism in the NRS. And what we have done is that we have realized this weakness in the NRS, and subsequently I can give you the assurance, Chair, that all three of those bullet points under IT weaknesses have been addressed or are being addressed. In particular, the segregation of duties, it has cost us more money because where we had one individual doing the job, we now have two individuals, and we have segregated that function. We have also, besides the fact that it has been raised as a concern, we had implemented compensating controls, which meant that we had behind the scenes reconciliation, so there was no transaction that went through by one individual and processed from end to end. I think that covers the Auditor General reports. If I can just respond to the questions regarding depreciation. The National Research Foundation is a highly technical, has a high level of technical assets that it holds. We've seen the investment in research infrastructure, in particular at the national facilities. As a result of the instruments that are located at these facilities, there is obviously going to be a high depreciation. It is correspondingly in line with the asset values of the organization. The other aspect that was raised was with regards to the transfers during the year. The transfers during the year, if one looks carefully on page 63, they relate to the previous financial year in 2006 and not 2007.